Welcome back, everyone, to the Damage Report. I'm John Arola. Big old show where we're not only going to be joined by, once again by US Senate candidate from Maine, Betsy Sweet, in just a little bit. She'll be breaking down how her race is developing, what Susan Collins has been up to, all of that. But we've got a lot more, too. Just a little bit from last night's debate, Bernie Sanders gave a particularly good answer on the topic of climate change and what needs to be done about the crisis we're facing. And I want to put it in some context of his past commentary on this issue and some of the related stuff that we've learned recently about what ExxonMobil learned about climate change as much as 40 plus years ago. So stick around for that too. We also have Ilhan Omar's new housing plan, great piece of legislation right there. And we're gonna be closing out the show with a tiny little study that shows what makes people trust or not trust poll results. It is not necessarily shocking, but it's important that you understand as we go into a time in the next year where we're gonna see a lot of different polls, what is gonna influence how people respond to it. And so we've got that coming up for you too. But before that, just a little bit of the fallout from yesterday's fairly bombshell testimony from Gordon Sondland. So we're gonna be starting off there with the impeachment inquiry. So yesterday, we know that a lot was revealed by Gordon Sondland. He confirmed really quickly, really succinctly that he believed that Donald Trump had set up a quid pro quo with the leadership of Ukraine. But what does Trump think about that day of testimony? Well, he was pretty confident and he feels like he has at least a few good defenders out there in right-wing media. And so I wanna analyze some of how they've been messaging around this. So he tweeted out some positive comments from Ken Starr saying, Ken Starr, former independent counsel, said, quote, does this reach the level of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors? My assessment of the evidence so far, nowhere close. The evidence is conflicting and ambiguous. Ambassador Sondland's testimony stated that President Trump said the Ukraine president should just do the right thing. No quid pro quo. You shouldn't charge, but you cannot convict a sitting president on the basis of conflicting and ambiguous evidence and destabilize the American government. Thank you, Ken. So that is what Ken Starr said. Obviously, Trump very much likes that. There's just a couple of issues with what Ken Starr said there. But even more importantly for Donald Trump, I would assume, there's issues with his belief that Ken Starr is providing a rock solid defense for him. So he quoted a part that makes it look like Ken Starr is totally on his side. But Ken Starr doesn't think he should be impeached. That doesn't necessarily mean he doesn't think that we've learned quite a bit of disturbing information. So here is more of Ken Starr's actual commentary.
Seems to me, no, we're just not there, that the President of the United States is going to be seen fairly by the American people as having committed some crime. Strong feelings, yes. Yelling into the phone, yes. Investigate the Bidens, yes. But was there, in fact, some sort of, quote, corrupt bargain? I just don't see the state of mind evidence there as yet.
Okay, so look, if you sort of pay attention to stuff in a very loose sort of way like Donald Trump does, you might hear that and just come away from it saying, oh, like we can't impeach him based on this. But he just said he's committed crimes and specifically, yes, he wanted them to investigate the Bidens, which is sort of the linchpin of this entire thing. But he's pretending that Ken Starr didn't say that. So he's confirming, yes, he wanted the Ukrainians to investigate the Biden specifically, not corruption in general or Burisma or whatever, Biden for his own personal interests. Now, I don't know exactly why Ken Starr thinks that that could be separated from what was being held over the heads of President Zelensky and the rest of Ukraine to get that. That seems like an important follow-up question, but unfortunately he's not on the show today. So I will simply say that he's admitting there that yes, Trump did push for those investigations. And we've been predicting this whole time, by the way, that the defense of Donald Trump, what form it takes, is going to shift every single day. And it's gonna move from initially, nothing was done, nothing was said, nothing ever happened wrong, all the way up to Ken Starr, a guy being lauded by the president for his defense, is saying, yeah, he committed crimes, yeah, he pushed a foreign policy to investigate the Bidens. And you've got people like Ben Shapiro's out there just tweeting, yeah, no, he totally tried to get those investigations. That's not even up for question anymore. Laura Ingraham, a couple days ago, we showed you, said, yes, it's bribery, but it's not bribery, which is an interesting legal take on that particular topic. And so this is what he is hiding behind as a defense at this point. The admitting that, yes, he committed crimes, but we'll see if anyone does anything about it effectively. By the way, Trump's take on yesterday, what was revealed, got even a little bit weirder. I mean, we showed you yesterday the I didn't do anything, I don't want anything defense. That was a bizarre moment for American political history. But he also said this, and it's about the fact that multiple witnesses have said they overheard Trump on phone calls with people like Gordon Sondland. Here's what Trump said. I have been watching people making phone calls my entire life. My hearing is and has been great. Never have I been watching a person making a call, which was not on speakerphone, and been able to hear or understand a conversation. I've even tried, but to no avail. Try it live. That's weird. That's like, so he admits, man, I've been trying to like eavesdrop on people's phones conversations for a long time. I just can't get it done. And I have got like super hearing, like, you know, Professor Xavier, sign me up for my earballs. But even I couldn't hear it. I hope that I never get in the position where my believed legal defense rests on, I have mutant hearing, it's impossible to eavesdrop on calls. What are you talking about, man? First of all, this has led to, you could go on Twitter, multiple people who've been in cars with him or people that he's talking to on the phone and could hear both sides. They're saying, no, in the direct example that you're giving, yes, I've done it, obviously. And all the rest of us, like, have you never heard someone's voice coming out of a phone? That's not difficult. That's not rare. Every Trump supporter knows that, man. You've heard people talking on the phone. Who is this convincing at this point? But these are the depths that he has had to descend to. And of course, I understand to some extent, yes, it's intended to be a bit of a distraction from the bombshells that were actually revealed yesterday. But I feel like we've done a pretty good job of summarizing that. So I'm not too worried about people missing what was revealed. It's interesting, though, Trump's response every day, what he's actually trying to push. But with that, these are not the only people defending Donald Trump. So I want to go a little bit broader and talk about some more of what came out yesterday in light of Gordon Sondland's testimony. So Gordon Sondland had a couple of big lines. One was summarized, I imagine, in a way that we're going to remember for a very long time. On the literal front page of the New York Times, we followed the president's orders. That's, I'm sure knowingly from the New York Times point of view, that's like a Nixon era front page right there that they're making in real time. And that's huge. That should be case closed, but it's not because we live in a ridiculous world. Here's the thing though, to have gotten that message, you had to read the New York Times or at least pass by one. And not everyone does. Some people get their news from other sources. So what if hypothetically you weren't getting your news from the paper of record? What if you were getting it from foxnews.com? Well, that sort of we follow the president's orders headline, that was all over places like CNN and MSNBC. Lots of places were talking about that, but not Fox. Fox had headlines like this. So this is literal front page Fox News throughout yesterday. So one is President Trump declares it's all over for impeachment inquiry after Sondland testimony. So okay, he did say that. That's technically true. And I've been really frustrated to see a bunch of tweets to that effect just saying Trump says it's over. Like, okay, I think he might be a little bit biased. Like if Obama had said it's all over on Benghazi, we're done with this thing, would that be the front page of Fox News on that? I kind of doubt it. But that's what took up that real estate for an hour or two. Later on, they had follow live. Sondland says Hunter Biden's board role clearly looks like conflict of interest. Because they are trying to sustain, like, what is there, 2% of America that thinks that Hunter Biden's an important part of this story? And they are trying to beam directly into the eyeballs of those people, their take on the news. They go on to say, follow live, Jordan pins Sondland for omitting Trump's key language from opening statement. Fox News is apparently the only person who's actually satisfied with Jim Jordan as a strong defender of the president there. No, Jordan is coming across as emotional and, you know, like jumping from one point to another, not being qualified for the position that they've pulled strings to get him into. And yet Fox News has to pretend that they're very satisfied with it too. So look, regardless of which part of this that they're focusing on, if it's Trump's weird performance during Chopper Talk or Jim Jordan or Hunter Biden, the important thing is they couldn't actually just clearly show what Gordon Sondland said. This guy, who's a huge fan of Donald Trump, like we've said many times, gave him $1 million. They have to pretend like he's some sort of antagonistic, anti-Trump guy. And you can't get the actual true information from him. But that's not that surprising after all. It is Fox News. What was a little bit more surprising was even the New York Times, who I gave credit to a little bit earlier, They have allowed Donald Trump to control this narrative in a way that never should have gotten off the ground. And that has to do with the big Sharpie printout of the phone call that he had with Gordon Sondland saying, I want nothing, I want nothing, I want no quid pro quo. Everybody keeps just saying that as if, oh yeah, that's another phone call like the others with Sondland. Just put that in the context of from May to September, there were a bunch of phone calls. No, the timeline in this case is incredibly important. And so when people leave it out, that's an issue. And not just people like Fox News, The Daily, the podcast, Michael Barbaro had this to say. So the most senior figure and the most involved figure in all of this from the Trump administration, who declares that this was a quid pro quo, he's talking about Gordon Sondland there, is simultaneously testifying that the president gets on the phone with him and says, this is no quid pro quo. That is complicated. Nicholas Fandos, their congressional correspondent, responds, it is. It's very complicated. And if you're listening at home and listening to Republican questioning, they're able, I think, to raise some doubts about this account that he's giving. No, no, The Daily, what are you talking about? That phone call wasn't in May. It wasn't in June or July. It was on September 9th. It was later in the day where the White House found out that the whistleblower had given his concerns to other people and this thing was exploding around them in real time. So yes, Trump finds out, whistleblower says you've been up to no good. And so Trump gets on the phone, calls up Sondland and says, I don't want a quid pro quo. That's not exculpatory, that's damning when you know the timeline. That doesn't make Trump look better, that makes him look way, way worse. That in a rush, an emergency move, he calls up Sondland and tries to get Sondland to agree with his interpretation of what happened. And The Daily leaves that out, doesn't say what day it was. For all we know, maybe it was in July, I don't know. It was back during the negotiations with Ukraine, who knows. Trump all along was really clear that he doesn't want a quid pro quo. And the New York Times write-up about that Trump conversation, the chopper talk thing, that also didn't mention the timeline. How could you leave that out? That is literally the only important piece of information on that. Trump has a horrible day with the Gordon Sondland testimony. He comes out with his account of this phone call to try to hijack the narrative. And the New York Times, let alone Fox News, we don't expect anything of them, but New York Times helps him to do that by hiding literally the most important piece of information. And people who should know way better are assisting the president in hoodwinking the American people. That is truly depressing. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back, Betsy Sweet's gonna be joining us on.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
you must unlearn what you have learned.
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
The other side. At last night's Democratic debate, we not only had, for I believe only the second time in history, an all-female moderating team, but we had some questions that hadn't been asked in the entire cycle yet, perhaps coincidentally with that team, especially involving things like family leave. And so to get into these and other issues, I wanna bring onto the show someone with a great record on these sorts of policies. Joining us once again on the show, Betsy Sweet, US Senate candidate for Maine. Betsy, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, hi John, how are you?
I'm doing well, how are you?
Great, thanks.
So before we jump into some of the policies individually, as I mentioned at the debate, we finally had a question about family leave. You have a history with that issue. So what did you think about that?
Well, I was glad to have any women's issue actually be talked about during the debate. But I was glad to hear the question about family medical leave. As you probably know, I actually wrote the first Family Medical Leave Act in the country in Maine, and then it became the basis for the current family leave. But now we're talking about paid leave so that everybody can access it, not just people with resources. So I think it's a really important issue, and I was glad they were talking about it, and I think it's time to pass it.
Yeah, and so look, we had three candidates who were asked about that: Andrew Yang, Amy Klobuchar, and Kamala Harris. They had different takes on it. Hypothetically, if you make it into the Senate, you could be working with one of those individuals or someone else to pass a bill. If you had been on the stage, what would you think would be a perfect answer if you were asked about family leave and what sort of bill we need to get to perhaps where some other countries have been for a long time?
Yeah. Well, I would say we definitely need paid family leave accessible to everyone, and it needs to be 6 months, because you know there's a lot of people who can't access it's a shared value in America. You know, no one thinks that when someone is sick and you have to take care of them or you have a baby that you should lose your job. So this is way overdue. So I would work really hard for paid family leave for everyone and to make sure that we pass it as soon as possible.
And I guess just a little bit more on that. I mean, we have to acknowledge that this debate was happening in Georgia. That's one of many states that over the past year or two has been the focal point of some pretty strong legal attacks against women's reproductive freedoms and other rights of those sorts. What did you think about the overall coverage outside of the family leave inside of the debate on issues affecting women?
Yeah, I think there hasn't been enough focus on it. You know, here in Maine, we're very focused on it since Susan Collins, the person I'm running against, was the deciding vote on Brett Kavanaugh.
Yeah.
And so our right to choose is completely under attack. And without that, there's no economic equality, there's no social equality, there's nothing. So I think we need to spend more time on that. And having just the right to it does not mean having access to it. So that relates to healthcare. You know, until we get healthcare for all and Medicare for all, those access doesn't mean anything. We have to actually be able to have coverage and have it in rural areas like in my state so that people can actually access those things. You know, we have to talk about pay equity. We have to talk about a lot of issues that affect over half the population, which have been pretty much absent from this debate.
So Betsy, you mentioned Kavanaugh there and her being the deciding vote. And I think her speech attempting to justify that vote is probably one of the most important speeches that she ever gave. And if there's any justice in the universe, people will remember her based on that speech. So at the time, there was a belief that that could be the deciding factor in her reelection bid. I haven't been following it incredibly closely. I have a feeling you probably have a pretty good opinion on that. How important, now that we're more than a year out, how important was that vote and that speech for the race that you're running against her right now?
It's really important for two reasons. One is that that was such a betrayal. It felt to so many of us like here was the one thing that she could have done to protect this right for a lifetime appointment, and she betrayed us. And so to listen to her for 45 minutes to find out that she was going to do what many of us had come to believe she was going to do all along was really, really hard. But I think it's just that and many other issues like the tax cut. You know, she has been the deciding issue on so many things that is different than she has been. You know, she has flip-flopped so many times, and she only votes moderately, as Maine people are demanding, when it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And
so people remember. Everybody remembers, believe me.
I hope so. And it's an incredibly important race right now. I think it's going to be one of the most important ones of this upcoming cycle. Before Susan Collins, though, there are other Democrats running in this race. For people who might not know necessarily a ton about your history or some of these other candidates, what are some of the important differentiating factors between you and some of the others who are pursuing this nomination?
So I'm someone who has been an advocate for women, for low-income folks, for healthcare, for the environment for 37 years in Maine. I call myself the sweet spot because I can't help it. somebody who has known how to bring people together to pass really important legislation to working families in Maine, but not been part of the broken rig system. So that's a special perspective I bring. And so I think it's really important. And I'm also the progressive person in this race. You know, I support Medicare for all. I support a Green New Deal. I support getting rid of student debt. And I'm the one who's actually speaking confidently with a plan to do all those things.
Yeah. So the description you were just giving there of you as the sweet spot, You didn't reference individual candidates. There are other candidates that hypothetically don't occupy that sweet spot. One potentially, yes, you could describe Sarah Gideon, the main House Speaker potentially as that. She apparently talks a lot about how we need bold leadership, but doesn't necessarily support some of the big sort of like the most important progressive legislation proposals that you do support. Do you think that support for things like Medicare for All or the Green New Deal, that those could be decisive in this primary between you and some of the other more establishment candidates?
Yeah, I think they will be decisive. You know, in 2016, Maine voted overwhelmingly for Bernie Sanders in the primary. So I think it is a shared value among Mainers, whether you call it, you know, progressive or conservative. People in Maine believe we have to do something about the climate. People in Maine believe that we have to have a living wage. People in Maine believe that we need healthcare for everybody. And so I think that lane is really does speak to Maine people, and she doesn't occupy it. You know, she is the chosen candidate of the political folks in Washington, and they want a moderate. They want someone who's going to come down and not necessarily stand up for the people of Maine, but accomplish their agenda, which is to be careful and cautious, as we know.
Betsy, where can people find out more about your campaign and your platform?
Thanks. If you go to BetsySweet.com, it's our website. And, you know, I think we're at a pivot point, John, in this race all over the country and especially here in Maine, which is if we want something that is different, if we want something that is not the corporate executives, that's not for the wealthy, but it's for real working people, I'm that candidate in this race. So go to BetsySweet.com, do what you can to help us out. And we really look forward to winning this and winning the big race against Collins in November.
Betsy Sweet, candidate for Senate in Maine. Thank you once again for joining us.
Thank you, John. Take good care.
You too. We're going to take a short break. We come back. Bernie Sanders, climate change, and the best way to advocate on these issues. We're going to give you some demonstrations of that after this. There are right ways to communicate around the climate crisis and wrong ways to communicate around the climate crisis. And then there is the best way to communicate about it. And I believe that last night at the Democratic debate, we saw a pretty good example of that. Here is a bit from what Bernie Sanders said.
I disagree with the thrust of the original question, because your question has said, what are we going to do in decades? We don't have decades. What the scientists are telling us, we don't get our act together within the next 8 or 9 years. We're talking about cities all over the world, major cities going underwater. We're talking about increased drought, talking about increased extreme weather disturbances. The United Nations is telling us that in the years to come, there are going to be hundreds of millions of climate refugees, causing national security issues all over the world. What we have got to do tonight, and I will do as president, is to tell the fossil fuel industry that their short-term profits are not more important than the future of this planet. And by the way, the fossil fuel industry is probably criminally liable, because they have lied and lied and lied when they had the evidence that their carbon products were destroying the planet. And maybe we should think about prosecuting them as well.
Thank you, Senator Sanders.
It is shocking to me that that is not a bigger headline coming out of the debate. That not only did he give by far the best answer on climate change, other people like Tom Steyer had some good commentary or whatever, but for the most part, it was people saying, yes, I think that climate change is real, and I think we should do something about it, and something, something, clean air and water. Not any sort of urgency, any sort of passion that is required for me as a skeptic when it comes to believing that politicians will do anything about this, for me to believe that you will actually prioritize it, that it won't be something you'll get to at some point in your presidency. Maybe you'll pass some sort of subsidy or something like that. No, that you not only have been out in front as a supporter and sponsor of the Green New Deal from the very beginning, but that it will be the highest priority for your administration. He made that very clear. No one, whether you're a Bernie Sanders supporter or not, can deny that he takes it more seriously than anyone else standing on that stage. We're going to return in a second to the end of his answer when it came to prosecuting fossil fuel executives. But here's the thing. It should not be a shock that Bernie Sanders is one of the best in the country on this issue, because he's been talking about it for longer than virtually anyone else. Here's some video from another Democratic debate back in October of 2015. He was asked not about climate change, but about the biggest national security threat facing the United States. And here's what he said.
Today, the scientific community is virtually unanimous
Climate change is real. It is caused by human activity. And we have a moral responsibility to transform our energy system away from fossil fuel to energy efficiency and sustainable energy and leave this planet a habitable planet for our children and our grandchildren.
So it was pretty quiet in response to that. I mean, there were people, commentators that night who were making fun of him. Like, he's asked about national security. He's talking about climate change. That's quaint. Look at grandpa. He's worried about the climate. He was proven right. 100%. 100% right. Everyone should have been answering the question in that way at that time. And the thing is, now many of them would bring it up. In no small part, I think, because some people had a lead on that issue. People like Bernie Sanders and a lot of the people in the crowd who were like, yeah, whatever, climate change. I technically care about that. I believe the scientists or whatever. But they didn't get fired up on the issue hearing about it at that point. I have to imagine that if they were listening to that same answer now, they would take it far more seriously. And all of that's to say that it matters that someone has been right on this issue for a very long time. But not only that. Right in the particular, in the right way. And so doing something about climate change doesn't just mean accepting the science. It doesn't just mean pushing for the right policy. It also means being willing to go up against the entrenched interests that have been the reason we haven't done anything about climate change this whole time. It's not like the scientists have been telling us the climate is changing and some people are skeptical. And then a mile away off in the woods, the fossil fuel companies are thinking, I wonder what's gonna happen in DC. No, they've been involved from the very beginning. In fact, they've known about this issue longer than anyone in politics, virtually anyone out in the civilian world. And because they knew and because they hid that information while profiting massively from a product that would kill thousands and thousands of people on a yearly basis, that is where Bernie Sanders comes in with his talk about the need to potentially prosecute them. So before we get to some of what they knew, I want to go back just a little bit this year when AOC in Congress was interviewing Dr. Hoffer. This is a former Exxon employee, and she summarizes really well what Exxon knew not a year or two ago, but decades and decades ago.
We have documents going back decades showing specifically that ExxonMobil or Exxon knew about climate change. In 1977, Exxon scientist James Black told Exxon's top executives that, quote, the most likely manner in which mankind is influencing the global climate is through carbon dioxide released from the burning of fossil fuels. This was in 1977. This was followed by an internal memo in 1979, which stated that, quote, the present trend of fossil fuel consumption will cause dramatic environmental effects before the year 2050.
So again, that's not the 2000s, that's not the 90s. That was internal research that was being conducted by Exxon back in the 70s, the late 70s. That's like 20 years before I was born. So it's a long time ago. They've known about this for a long time. And they knowingly lied about it. Not only to fool some politicians, but for the most part to fool the American public into continuing massive subsidies to these companies, lack of interest or money or funding or anything like that for alternative energies. And Inside Climate did a great mashup of graphics. I'm gonna show you right now between what they knew internally and what their highest representatives were saying publicly. So James Black, Exxon senior scientist in 1978, in a report says, in the first place, there is general scientific agreement that the most likely manner in which mankind is influencing the global climate is through carbon dioxide release from the burning of fossil fuels. So that was what Exxon knew in 1978. Nearly two decades later, Lee Raymond, the Exxon chairman and CEO, says, currently the scientific evidence is inconclusive as to whether human activities are having a significant effect on the global climate. That is not only a lie in 1997, even if you hadn't done the research, you should know better in the late 90s, but they did know. From the time James Black said that quote, you could have had a kid, they could have grown up, they could have gone to college, and they could be working on their dissertation on climate change, and he's out in public pretending that they don't know what's actually going on. One more example, James Black went on to say, present thinking holds that man has a time window of 5 to 10 years before the need for hard decisions regarding changes in energy strategies might become critical. 1978, but Lee Raymond in the late 90s said, it is highly unlikely that the temperature in the middle of the next century will be significantly affected whether policies are enacted now or 20 years from now. And he said that 20 years from when James Black was warning them that there is a clock ticking on this thing. And here's the thing, if we had done something about this when James Black was writing, we could have been gradual as hell. It could have been a tiny little tweak here, a little bit more fuel efficiency each year there. and we would have been perfectly fine. If we had been serious in 1997 when Lee Raymond was giving his quote, it would have been tougher, but not that bad. We could have transitioned, you know, in terms of our energy production. We could have done more sustainability in our homes and things like that. But no, because people like Lee Raymond lied, and because opportunistic politicians were getting paid by companies like Exxon, we're left in a really horrendous situation where we need to go full force into this thing. And even then, we will not be able to avoid all of the worst effects of climate change. If we had listened to Bernie Sanders back in that 2015 debate, we'd be significantly better off. But we are where we are, The thing now is, what can be done about these CEOs who knew and lied and profited while people died because of the pollution that they were putting out, because of the climate change that they were knowingly contributing to? Now, I don't know that Bernie Sanders is necessarily going to launch any lawsuits, but I can say go out there and do your research, because there's a lot of them right now. Local, state, and international lawsuits targeting fossil fuel companies and CEOs, many of them youth-led. Those are going on right now, okay? And I think that's exactly the tack we need to take. Now, Bernie Sanders on this particular issue, he's not the only one who's right. Senator Elizabeth Warren has also proposed legislation to hold corporate executives, including heads of fossil fuel companies, criminally liable for causing harm to their environment. And that is the right position. But it is a very different thing to do what Bernie Sanders does, which is to use the limited amount of time that you have as a candidate on that debate stage to make sure that people know where you stand on the most important issue, what needs to be done, and who we're going to be fighting against along the way. Bernie did that, and the others, there's still time to learn from that example. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back, lots more to get to.
You came to the US at the age of 7. You joined the US military for many reasons. Promise of citizenship. Most important, you served your country. How could they deport you?
So there you see an excerpt from Ready for War, a documentary that profiles three vets who served America, were willing to give literally everything for this country, and then America did not have their back and in fact deported them. There's three people profiled in that film. One, Hector Barajas joins us now. Hector, welcome to the Damage Report.
Hi, good afternoon, and thank you guys for having me at this program, and very super excited.
thank you so much for joining us, and also for detailing your story in this documentary. So, I hope that everyone goes and watches the film, but give us an idea of what your experience was like.
The documentary shows a lot of the maybe briefly about 2 years before I came came home, but it basically. I was deported for over 14 years, and it was very difficult. They were able to get a little parts of my life, but it was very difficult. I was homeless at one point, living on the streets of Tijuana, and it was very, very difficult. But I persevered and kept moving forward, and here today because of that.
And so you were deported after serving. If you can put yourself back in the position before you joined the U.S. military. How would that change your relationship with the country? How would that make people view you? How would the US government view you if you served and potentially you were risking your life to serve in our military?
Sure. I mean, the military, when they recruit you, they don't, as far as even being an immigrant, they want you to join the service. And I'm proud to have served in the government, in the military, regardless of my deportation. I wouldn't take anything back. But it's definitely important that when we bring our immigrant soldiers into the military, that we assure that they get their citizenship and don't lose their green card. Most people don't know that you could lose your green card as well for various infractions. And we have veterans that didn't commit any crimes and they've been deported as well. So it varies from person to person.
Now, there's a quote that you give in the movie that is pretty amazing. You say, "I still consider myself an American, a patriot. I will keep fighting to go home. I'm proud of my service. I wouldn't take it back if I had to do it all over again. I would serve my country, put my life on the line." I mean, I think a lot of people see what happened to you, how you did all of that. And then, in a very real way, you were betrayed by the country that you gave so much to. So, I mean, I guess I'm just curious, how do you maintain that belief that I don't know, I don't think that I could do it after going through what you've gone through?
Sure. Well, you know, one of the interesting things that I had to reflect on for many years is, or even talk about, basically just about every day, because I'm always posting on social media and doing different interviews, but is citizenship and what it means to be an American was always brought up, and I always had to reflect on it. And after having experienced the American dream as a young child, and then serving, and then getting deported, then it's like, you know, things like you don't know what you have until you lose it.
Yeah.
And when I lost living in America, and it just, man, it really, everything just started hitting me. Like, you know, just even having some burgers and some fries, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, just like that, you know. I mean, that, and the soldiers know it, you know, like the ones that are, you know, in tours or whatnot, and then they're deployed. They know what it is to miss those little things, and so yeah, it's tough, you know. But I get angry more myself because of the mistakes that I made. And when I do get angry is when I see the deported veterans come home. And we had a guy that was murdered, and he was brought home, and he's buried with his dad in New Mexico. And wow. They gave his mother an American flag, and they said, "Thank you for your service." I'm like, "Oh, so now we thank you, you know, but we couldn't bring you home for the last 15, 20 years, you know." So that makes me angry.
Yeah, the way that we support our troops, it works in some areas, but not in others. And it certainly seems to be contingent on a lot of things. It seems reasonable to me that if somebody goes into the military, serves, and leaves, you get your citizenship. You've earned it. Do you agree with that? Do you think that would be reasonable?
Sure. I think we should definitely have expedited citizenship. One of the problems that we have in the military is that we don't have a program. So there is a process for you to become a citizenship. Over the years, it's varied from one day in combat to, you know, they sometimes would help you get your citizenship during basic training back in 08, 09, around those times. But we've never had an actual program in place throughout the whole military, and where you are actually counseled and they tell you what the forms are. This is the person that's going to take care of you. And people say, "Well, we're not there to hold your hand." Yes, we are. We do hold your hand. We show you how to march. We show you how to use a weapon, how to take somebody's life. Why not make sure that your paperwork is done before you go off to Afghanistan or Vietnam? We certainly do that in other ways. We make sure you have your immunizations. Make sure that if you're an airborne guy like me, that your airborne status is up to date and you've jumped within the last 6 months. So why not make sure that citizenship is a priority as well?
Exactly. And Hector, I don't want to spoil too much of the movie because I want people to watch it. But just briefly, I want to talk about there's three vets who are profiled, of which you're one, in the movie. And what happens to these vets after they're deported, it can go in a couple of very different directions. And so talk a little bit about what you did with your work with establishing the bunker.
Basically, I decided to... you know what, this is not right. We have to do something about it. And at the beginning, it was just, to be honest with you, I just started out of my apartment and just didn't really have an idea, and would never have thought that I'd be doing documentaries or speaking to media or having, I've had congressional visits. Mm-hmm. Just had Senator Tammy Duckworth, who's in the film, visit us on Veterans Day. I would have never thought I would have had a senator visiting me in Tijuana. So, but yeah, I just kept, you know, one day at a time and just moving forward. And thank God that we were able to get people to listen to us. You know, for many years, I would be at the border just with a sign up, and nobody would listen. Sometimes even the deported veterans wouldn't come out. And that's one of the difficult things, is to getting the people that are being affected to fight back or to get involved. And for many years, it felt like I was a one-man person out there, one-man army. And now we're starting to see things change. You know, it's definitely... things are moving ahead, and this has been going on for over 20-something years. So,
yeah,
been a long road.
And so, you talked about the difficult path that you had, but you found time to help other soldiers that have been deported along the way. Others in their need to find work, sometimes in an area that they don't have much experience with. People are being deported that they don't know the area they're being deported to. And apparently, it's popular for cartels to try to recruit some of these people with military training. Can you talk a little bit about that, what the appeal of these soldiers is to the cartels?
Sure. You know, it's not just necessarily deported veterans, but a lot. Well, I'm not sure. I wouldn't say a lot. There are even Mexican soldiers and people from other countries that come and work for the cartels, because, you know, if you're up against the enemy, you don't want people that have never used weapons before. I mean, they take them, but you know, if you have somebody that has the military training that's taken a life, then Jesus, I'd rather have that guy than a guy that has no experience with weapons. So it does happen to certain veterans. It's an issue that I try to really avoid because, you know, I don't talk about any direct cartels or anything like that because, you know, I still live in Tijuana. I have men that live all over the country of Mexico, and, you know, we don't want to put anybody's life in danger, but it happens, you know.
Definitely. And, you know, obviously stay safe. We really appreciate the work that you're doing and helping through telling your story for people to understand that this is happening. Because I think for a lot of Americans, they have no idea that someone could give so much to the country and to just be kicked out afterward. It's really shocking. And so the movie is Ready for War. Hector, I really hope that a lot of people watch it and learn about your story. And we really appreciate you joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, just a little bit more to close out the show. So what is the difference between a person trusting a poll and the results of a poll and not trusting it? Well, you might think, oh, it's the methodology, how many people they talk to. Maybe the source, you know, is this a reputable, long-standing pollster with a good track record? Well, maybe that has some influence, but unfortunately, some of it is just simple human psychology and it's a little bit depressing. A study from the Annenberg Public Policy Center and University of Michigan found that Americans are more likely to dismiss the results of a poll if they find those results unfavorable to their political leanings. An excerpt from the actual study says, in a nationally representative sample, we find that individuals disproportionately find polls more credible when their preferred candidate is leading. And that is just a reminder that we are at the end of the day, simple, simple animals. That's all that we are. We think that things are true if they feel good. Oh, if it's nice and it makes me happy and warm to think that it's true. And that has nothing to do with whether or not a poll is credible. Now, it's not to say that, you know, it coming from a particularly reputable pollster doesn't matter at all. It does. And they do have advice, which we'll get to. But if I like the results or not, that should have no impact. I'm sure that even for me it does. But we gotta get better at recognizing these biases so that we can weed them out. So let's turn to a little bit of positive information. They do have some advice. Went on to find that publicizing a poll's methodology is the best way to dispel illusions of partisan bias in objective sampling of the population. And they say specifically, this is Ozan Kuru says, if people focus on these objective aspects of polls, they may be less likely to immediately dismiss results that they find unfavorable. And hopefully that's true. I'm sure that they have some evidence that that's true. And for regular people, maybe. Like, if an article breaks down a poll, it should definitely give a link to the raw data, to the methods, all of that so people can actually look at it. I know that 99 out of 100 won't, but it should be there, but that's not gonna work for everybody. So they say that this will help to correct for partisan bias. But unfortunately, even when the methods are there, it runs up against partisan bias. So in recent days, I know nobody has cared about that, but I broke down in detail an op-ed for The Hill and a Sean Hannity segment, both of which discounted the results of a poll because from what they said, it talked to too many Democrats and not enough Republicans. And so if you're a regular person listening to that or reading that op-ed, you might think, yeah, wait, why did they talk to more Democrats than Republicans? How could the poll possibly be reputable or reliable if they did that? But here's the thing. It's not like you had to go to the raw data. In the articles they were themselves linking to, it talked about how the results were weighted to correct for the fact that they talked to too many Democrats and not enough Republicans. It's not like people whose literal career, their life's work is crafting polls, don't know that that could throw off the results, and so they have statistical methods to fix for it. But either the writer of that op-ed and Sean Hannity don't understand what that means, and that's a very real possibility because people love to talk about polls without having any idea how they're actually created, or they can't be bothered to read about it. And so it's great advice to say that that should be there. That'll help for some people, but there are some partisan actors that don't care whether a poll is reliable. They care about a narrative that they want to help sustain. And sometimes, I'm gonna keep it real, I feel like a crazy person when I see people talking about polls. I believe it's safe to say that I'm literally one of the only people in media who has taken multiple courses in how to create and run and analyze polls. It's not a required thing in journalism for people to understand that. to do whole segments on it, to write up op-eds about it. But we can learn about polls. We can learn what makes for a reliable poll and what doesn't. And maybe for a regular person, it doesn't matter. They're not writing op-eds or whatever. But if you are led astray by commentators that are trying to hoodwink you by pretending that some polls aren't reliable when they are, well, then you're going to run up against reality on election day. When you believed you thought what was you knew what was going on, and then when the actual vote comes in, you're going to be shocked. I don't want people to go through that sort of psychological stress. So do a little bit of reading about how polls are created, how to analyze polls. It's out there if you want to learn. Now with that, okay, we have a little bit more. So we are going to do an overtime. So stick around. If you're a member, you can watch this. If not, tyt.com/John, you become a member. We're going to be talking about Ilhan Omar and her housing plan on the other side of this. The framework that is the Green New Deal obviously involves a lot of different issues, and it's already generating multiple pieces of legislation. Take a look at this video where Representative Ilhan Omar announces her new Green New Deal inspired housing plan.
One of the first things I noticed when I came to the United States were people sleeping on the side of the streets. And I have been on a mission ever since to make sure that there are no humans left in that situation. Today, I'm excited to introduce the Homes for All Act, which will fulfill the promise of a homes guarantee by building 12 million new public housing and private permanently affordable rental units, fastly expanding the available affordable housing stock, driving down costs throughout the market, and creating a new vision of what public housing looks like in the United States of America. We will prohibit any discrimination against residents based on sexual orientation, gender, and criminal history or immigration status. The bill also creates a new anti-displacement fund with HUD in order to protect families from gentrification, prevent displacement, and stabilize neighborhoods. And it makes public housing a mandatory part of our budget, like Social Security and Medicare. All of this will be built to the highest environmental standards, making this a key part of the Green New Deal.
So that's a great video. We're going to have a few details in just a second. Really fast, you might be thinking, wait, didn't Bernie and AOC come out with a Green New Deal, a public housing plan a week ago? And they did. It's not the same plan. It is complementary. That plan had more to do with upgrading existing stock of housing and providing some extra funding and things like that. This is more focused on actually increasing the raw number of units that are available to help get more people into a home. And so very complementary bills. They should both be passed. And this is a major issue that thankfully more and more politicians are taking seriously. At last night's debate, there were a couple of questions about housing. It's very common these days for presidential candidates to have a housing plan because they understand that for a lot of Americans, the idea of owning a home isn't just like a big hurdle, it's effectively impossible. I mean, I can say I grew up, my parents never owned a home. I'm lucky enough that I'm doing in some ways better than them, but I live in LA. And so the idea that I could own a home is crazy. Like best case scenario, I could maybe find something an hour outside of the city and I'd probably be taking part in gentrifying an area to even do that. It's become effectively impossible for more and more people, and not just in cities in LA. Ilhan Omar has done a great job in some of her other communication around this bill in making clear that this is an increasing problem even in suburban and rural areas in the center of America. And so we need politicians with bold plans to deal with the increasing issues of housing, not only in the stock, but also the monopolies of real estate developers that are creating artificial scarcity to drive up prices. These are huge problems, and this is a big bill to help deal with that. Just a little bit more details on it. Her bill's dubbed the Homes for All Act. It outlines a plan to build 9.5 million new units of public housing at the cost of about $800 billion. The legislation earmarks $200 billion for a federal housing trust fund to build 2.5 million new affordable housing units available for low-income families. Another $200 billion would establish a community control and anti-displacement fund at the Department of Housing and Urban Development to provide grants to local governments to combat the effects of gentrification. And you saw in that video, she mentioned climate change. Like with the AOC Bernie public housing plan, This is a big part of dealing with climate change too. Real estate accounts for at least 12% of the planet heating emissions in the US. Some people estimate it could be as high as 39%. And so yes, we have to deal with transportation, energy production, those sorts of things, but housing is a very important part of that as well. And public housing, establishing new housing can be a great way to do something about this. So great bill by Ilhan Omar. You can find out more details online. Just one other thing I want to say about this. As members of the squad, effectively all of whom are, they're new to politics. They're in their first year and a half of being congresspeople. They're doing so much, coming out with so many bills on like a biweekly basis. It makes me wonder, what the hell are other people in Congress doing with their time? There are people who have been in Congress for 2 years, 4 years, 6 years, no bills to their name. I mean, I know technically we know what they're doing. They're spending 6 hours a day making calls to raise money for their reelection. But like, think about taking that weight off your shoulders and what you can do with that time. You can be putting together AOC's anti-poverty plan or her public housing plan. Ilhan Omar with this new bill, it takes a lot of time, a lot of research and resources, and you'd be freed up to do that sort of work and to get the accolades that you get rightfully for doing that kind of work if you get into office in the right way with the right sort of funding. So anyway, good on Ilhan Omar, both in the way she campaigned and the way she's actually holding the office now. With that, that's all the time we have. Thank you everybody for watching, not only the regular show, but also the overtime that we have here. Really appreciate you tuning in. Tomorrow, Brett Ehrlich joins me once again on the show. We'll see you then. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.